Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Donald Trump's defeat in the US presidential election has sparked a flurry of activity on the Washington-Jerusalem-Tehran axis. High-ranking Israeli and American officials are meeting, army chiefs are consulting, and newspapers are reporting on a daring operation by Israeli agents on the streets of Tehran. Joining me today to separate the fact from the fiction and to help us prepare for a possible December surprise, I'm joined by Amos Harel and Amir Tibon. Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine, all things considered.
Good.
Not bad at all.
Excellent. So let's start with the headline that was splashed across the internet over the weekend, which originated in the New York Times, and according to which Al-Qaeda's second highest leader, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, was gunned down on the streets of Tehran in August by Israeli operatives at the behest of the United States. According to the report, he was killed symbolically on the anniversary of the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Iran, almost needless to say, has denied the report, calling it a Hollywood scenarios. So the first question that we need to ask is, to the best of our knowledge, is the report accurate?
As far as I can tell, it's completely reliable.
And so this happened, and it happened when it happened, and the details in the report that we won't go into right now are as far as we know, they are correct.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense for the United States and Israel to be behind such an operation on the one hand, and it also makes perfect sense for the Iranians to deny it, since the victim of the assassination was not Iranian, and he's in fact an Al-Qaeda official. This is something that Tehran has no reason to admit. The whole relationship between Iran and Al-Qaeda is quite strange, because you have a radical Shiite country on the one hand and an extremely radical and hostile Sunni group on the other. But this is not the first time they've been cooperating. I think the general intention from Tehran's perspective is to try and cultivate those organizations in order to control some of their activity on the one hand and to prevent them from attacking inside Iran on the other.
But Tehran has traditionally denied even hosting Al-Qaeda terrorists on its soil, right? And it would be quite convenient for those seeking to build a case against the Islamic Republic if it were now to be evident that there are Al-Qaeda terrorists on Iranian soil.
Yes, this is quite embarrassing for Iran. First of all, for actually... hosting them, and secondly, for not being able to protect them. They were taken by surprise. And it's not the first time. If you look back, what we've seen in Iran in the last decade or so is that their security services are having a very, very hard time to prevent such incidents, whether it's the Israelis stealing the nuclear archives 2.5 years ago, whether it was the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientists 8 and 10 years ago, or all kinds of mysterious incidents. The last of these was the early July of this year, when there was suddenly an explosion at the nuclear site in Natanz. So quite a lot of things are happening to Iran, to the Iranian regime, and it seems, at least for the time being, that they're almost incapable of defending their security interests.
So who was this al-Masri fellow, Amos? According to Channel 12 television, unnamed Western intelligence sources said that he'd recently begun planning attacks against Israeli and Jewish targets across the world.
I wouldn't know about that, but if you look at his history, this is a man who was deeply involved in all kinds of attacks against Western targets in East Africa, whether it was Tanzania or Kenya more than 20 years ago, the attacks on the American embassies there. And later on, there was an attack, I think it was 19 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, on Israeli and Western tourists in Mombasa, Kenya. So Al-Qaeda was at that time very much involved in these attacks, and as far as we can tell, this guy played a major part in those incidents.
So
he was wanted by the Americans for quite some time, and apparently, at least according to the New York Times report, it was the Israelis that were helpful in order to settle the score with him.
Mm. We're not going to get into the question of who and how the hit was carried out, obviously, but I do recommend Yossi Melman's article about the rich history of Mossad operations on foreign soils, which I understand will be going live on the website very shortly. Ever since Trump's election defeat, and I think we're safe in calling it an election defeat, there's been increased speculation about possible military strike against Iran, either by the United States or by Israel. Since this report is based on statements from unnamed intelligence officials, which is often the case with these sensitive military and diplomatic stories, does it make you wonder about the timing of the publication?
I think the timing is tied to all these speculations about a possible American or Israeli strike. It's also tied to the passing of the guard. The fact that Trump has lost the election and that Biden is president-elect and should be entering the Oval Office by January 20th means that there's quite a lot of tension in the Pentagon, in the CIA, among anybody having anything to do with the Iranian portfolio about where the policy is heading. And as you mentioned, there's always the question about what Trump would choose to do during that time. I wouldn't put it past him to go forward with some kind of a military attempt which would be aimed towards Iran. Airstrikes, massive airstrikes, don't seem likely, mostly because of the time frame. If you look back, you remember between around 2009 and 2013, almost every summer there were discussions, some in the press, mostly it happened behind the scenes, about whether Israel was about to strike Iran. To finally unilaterally hit Iran's nuclear site. It never materialized, and by now we know that a lot of this had to do with the fact that the generals and Mossad chiefs and so on were heavily against it, and they opposed Netanyahu's plan at that time. But it was always during the spring and summer months, and at that time, all kinds of military experts said, well, an attack during winter is almost impossible because of the weather in Iran, which would make it very, very hard for any kind of air force to accurately hit the target.
Mm.
So I would assume the same is true for the Americans right now, and I don't see a real interest there to go for a full-scale strike against the Iranians. Whether Trump would go for some kind of a sabotage campaign or similar attacks like the one you mentioned regarding this Al-Qaeda official. This remains to be seen. I think that there's more of a possibility of something like that, perhaps with some kind of cooperation with the Israelis, than for that scenario of a huge airstrike, which would put the different countries very close to a full-scale war, which is something that I don't think Trump wants to be remembered for that. You have to look back at his history. Mostly it was about the isolationist sentiments and not the opposite.
Mm. And in the meantime, the Israeli sabotage operations continue all the time, according to reports, right?
Again, Israel, the only time where Israel took complete responsibility openly was the story of the nuclear archives. And even then, it took a few months until Netanyahu addressed that publicly. You remember his press conference, which was timed to Trump's announcement about pulling out of the nuclear agreement. These happened within a few days, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe Amir could correct me, in May 2018. Other than that, there were numerous reports about all kinds of Israeli sabotage missions inside Iran. Some of them had to do with the nuclear site. And of course, what we have on top of that is the Israeli Air Force strikes all over the place, in Syria, in Lebanon, and reportedly sometimes even in Iraq. And these are mostly against the Iranians' operation of smuggling sophisticated weapons, that the end target usually is Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Mm. There's also a bit of a flurry of diplomatic activity, right? Elliot Abrams, Trump's special representative on Iran and Venezuela, and of course a former Iran-Contra conspirator, was here. And this week's sommelier-in-chief Mike Pompeo is coming to give his stamp of approval to a West Bank winery. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, reportedly held a video call with his Israeli counterpart, Aviv Kochavi. What message are they bringing and sending Israel regarding Iran?
So the Americans are very active right now. Some of the people are actually quite active in denying that Trump actually lost the elections as well. I attended sort of an on-record briefing with Elliot Abrams last week. I don't know what Pompeo would do once he arrives here. But the general message is we continue to be tough on Iran. The maximum pressure campaign works. And we should increase the pressure for the time being until there's a new administration. Neither Abrams, who of course is a state official, or Pompeo have yet acknowledged the fact that Biden had won. Mm. Abrams said that it wasn't up to CNN or Fox to announce the winners, while Pompeo actually went one step further, and he said that Washington was waiting for a transition between first Trump administration and the second. So we'll see how he behaves here. But I think what we can see already is that although Netanyahu maintains this policy or attitude of flattery towards Trump, I think he's beginning to keep a distance, to try and keep a distance from the president, because everybody except for those in the Trump universe by now acknowledges that the result is quite clear and that Biden is going to enter the Oval Office by January 20th. So Netanyahu would probably be careful about that. We've noted it already that he hasn't called Biden or congratulated him on the phone, but he will probably be quite cautious. On the one hand, not to hurt Trump's feelings, but on the other, not to go too far ahead with Trump conspiracies or anything like that. I think he would probably prefer to maintain a distance from this until the new president is in the White House.
Mm, but Trump does still have a couple of months left in office, and and he's already
over 2 months.
He's already shaking up the top Pentagon echelons, trying to put more and more right-wing Trump loyalists into key positions for this transition period. Anthony Tata, for example, who once called Obama a terrorist leader who wants to destroy Israel, and a hardline hawker like Ezra Cohen Watnick. Is there a sense that Trump, who's supposed to be a lame duck, could actually be getting his Iranian ducks in a row?
It's hard to tell. I think some of it has to do with older scores he'd like to settle. When it comes to former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, I think it has more to do with his resentment or even refusal to send in the troops to Washington, D.C. during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations during the summer. We saw General Milley taking the same kind of attitude. After they were both sort of coerced by Trump to follow him during that visit to the church near the White House at one occasion. I think later on, both of them kept their own distance from Trump. And Amir could probably correct me on this again, but as far as I can tell, this was in the cards. It was very, very clear that they were going to get rid of Esper after the election. It's hard to tell whether these people are now put in place in order to move forward with some kind of Trump aggressive plan towards Iran. I'm not sure if that's the case. I think it's part of the general atmosphere around the president right now, and I don't think it directly has anything to do with events in our region.
Mm. Amir, is that your sense too?
We're all guessing about the motivations behind what Trump is doing, but I tend to agree with Amos. One of the people that has also been installed in a senior position as part of this purge at the Pentagon and the installment of Trump loyalists is Douglas MacGregor, retired colonel. And we put up a report this weekend about some interesting statements that he's made about the Israel lobby, saying that politicians in America get very rich by being nice to Israel, saying that Mike Pompeo gets millions from the Israel lobby and the Saudi lobby. This is not exactly the kind of person who would now lead the Pentagon to a war with Iran. And some of the other people that have been put in high-profile positions right now also have more of an isolationist streak. than a interventionist one. So this could just as well be about what Amos mentioned, the Trump wanting the Pentagon to get involved against protesters in the United States and Esper refusing, but it could also be about Afghanistan. Trump really wants to finish his term, assuming that he agrees that, you know, his term is coming up to an end, but whether he agrees or not, it's going to happen in 2 months. He would really want to finish by taking U.S. forces out of Afghanistan and maybe also out of some bases in Western Europe. And of course, then he's handing that bill off to Biden. Will Biden send the troops back after Trump withdrew them? Because that would be what the military will be asking. But will he actually take that kind of unpopular political step? Definitely, you know, an interesting question, and I think it's more about that. And also one other explanation that to me makes a lot of sense. Some of the names you've mentioned, the people that have been installed in these positions, will now control the flow of intelligence and will be able to play around a bit with older intelligence, whether it is to make it more difficult to access intelligence that could be embarrassing to Trump and his administration, or to try to dig out of the archives intelligence that could somehow help Trump rehabilitate his image on the Russia issue, which still haunts him 4 years after that election of 2016.
So it's strategic rather than tactical for the short term?
Again, all options are on the table, and it could be just pure revenge on Esper and other officials that didn't play along with some of his wishes. But I tend to agree with Amos that, you know, war with Iran is the less likely explanation for all of these maneuvers in the Pentagon.
And of course, the Americans famously say they're not traffic cops here to give green lights or red lights to any other country, i.e. Israel.
Well, if Netanyahu wants to start a war, regional war right now, when Israel is dealing with the third wave of COVID that is arriving on our shores, that's an issue for us to discuss, but I don't think it has anything to do with the changes in the Pentagon.
And again, I think what we've seen in recent months is that Netanyahu is still obsessed with the Iranian issue, naturally. This was his calling card for a very long time. But I don't think it's any longer top priority. If you look at what he's dealing with recently, this is mostly about political survival and getting out of his legal troubles. He cannot add to the mix right now a direct Israeli military strike against Iran. If he can persuade the Americans to do that, I don't find this likely, but maybe it was something that could have interested him. But pushing forward for an Israeli military strike right now, under these circumstances, be they economic or just considering the virus itself, it doesn't seem like a very likely scenario to me.
So what about the idea of preemptive scorched earth for the Iran nuclear deal? We know Trump has already pulled out of it. Surely he would like nothing better than to scupper any chances of Biden being able to revive that.
On this issue, I'm not sure it's Trump himself that cares too much. Maybe even politically, it could be convenient for him if Biden re-enters the Iran deal, assuming he would want to run for president again in 2024. Yes, there is already chatter about that in Washington. But I think there are other people in the administration who are much more ideologically committed to killing the Iran deal completely and getting the United States and Iran to a much more tense place. Pompeo, Elliot Abrams, and other names obviously are on the list. And for those people, definitely trying to create a situation where it's more difficult for Joe Biden to re-enter the Iran deal would be a priority between now and January 20. Trump himself, he's more concerned right now with the fraud in the voting machines and all of those other stupid conspiracy theories and the weird lawsuits that Rudy Giuliani is placing in courts all over the country and losing as of now. But for Pompeo, for Elliot Abrams, making it more difficult to re-enter the Iran deal is definitely a top priority until they are out of the administration.
But they might not have time to put the kibosh on it completely?
Well, they would do whatever they can. And for Pompeo, by the way, there is another element, which is, of course, the positioning himself politically for 2024 as well. So if he can go out as the tough man who fought Iran until the very last second, that will not hurt him by the time we get to the Iowa caucuses of 2024. I can't believe I just said those words, but it's part of what we're seeing around right now.
I think Pompeo would make good use of his visits right now, both for the PR and political aspects of his image. We'll probably see that during the next few days. And also, perhaps, with his dealings behind the scenes with people like Netanyahu or the chiefs of IDF and Mossad and so on.
I mean, it certainly wouldn't harm his chances in 2024, as you say, Amir, or being the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit a West Bank settlement.
Well, that's, of course, part of the political game. And I think it wants Pompeo, for him, that would be part of a legacy that he wants to go. It's interesting, by the way, when Pompeo was the director of the CIA in the early, in the first year of the Trump administration, he was actually seen as one of the moderating forces around the president at the time. It's funny to look back on it. I think right around the time that Netanyahu came to Washington for his first visit to the Trump White House, Pompeo was sent to Ramallah and had a meeting with Mahmoud Abbas. And one of the last meetings that Pompeo had as director of the CIA, maybe even the last kind of, you know, meeting with an official from another country, was with the head of the Palestinian intelligence forces, Majid Farage. And he was seen as someone who, at least on our issue, actually was not such an extremist and had some, you know, sensible ideas. But of course, Secretary of State, unlike Director of the CIA, is a position where you are in the spotlight and there are cameras transfixed on you all the time. And this is political, what he's doing right now, no question about it. He is setting up his own kind of political legacy, looking forward to his attempt to be the Republican nominee, which of course would be completely useless if Trump runs again in 2024, but there is more time. We'll get to it.
What else should we be looking out for on the American political front, Amir? Which are the key Biden appointments that you're going to be looking out for?
Well, first of all, any appointments are all going to be reliant on the result of the Senate races in Georgia in early January that will determine control of the Senate. And, of course, if the Democrats have 50 seats in the Senate and then Vice President-elect Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker, Biden would have much more freedom in terms of who he can appoint to what positions. If the Republicans keep the Senate, so any Biden appointment would need the support of two or three Republicans. It's possible for him to get it. There are several Republicans who are open to working with him. Susan Collins in Maine, Mitt Romney in Utah, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania and others.
If anyone can reach out across the aisle, it's Biden.
Absolutely.
Right?
He has a history of working with these people, and I'm not concerned for him. But what it would mean is that any appointment would need their stamp of approval, and therefore it would tilt more towards center-left, moderate nominees for every position, Secretary of State, Director, everything that requires Senate approval. I'm not sure if that's a bad scenario for Biden, by the way, because I think Biden, he really is a centrist Democrat, a moderate, a pragmatic politician. And I'm not sure he wants to have a situation where the left wing of the Democratic Party has too much influence over him and can make all kinds of demands. He would rather be in a situation where he needs to compromise because that's his political identity for the last 47 years.
Right. He's hoping that somebody will twist his arm into compromising.
And I think he'll be open to working with Republicans. Obviously, it's interesting. For us in Israel, I think the most interesting questions, you know, would be who are the people that he will put around in the State Department and in the Pentagon. One story that has been running around is that for the Pentagon position, he wants to put a woman for the first time. And the leading candidate, Michelle Flournoy, I don't think anyone in Israel would be unhappy about her appointment. She's a solid choice, and she's worked with Israeli officials in, you know, government, military, intelligence, and has a good history over there. In terms of the State Department, one name that's been floated that I think would make people in Jerusalem a bit uncomfortable is Susan Rice, who used to be Obama's national security advisor. But again, then, you know, the Senate comes into question and would she get approved? Other names, Chris Coons, a senator from Delaware, who is a favorite of the pro-Israel lobby in the Democratic Party, AIPAC favorite, I think, obviously, that would be welcomed much differently in Jerusalem. And perhaps there are other names that we, you know, haven't really been mentioned yet, and Biden will bring them to the front and surprise everyone.
His January surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. January, February, and beyond.
In the meantime, how much are you looking forward to reading Obama's new memoir, Amir? We've already got some of the juicy quotes about Bibi, of course. There's a lot of stuff in there about AIPAC too, right?
Yes, he does criticize AIPAC for their kind of blind allegiance with Netanyahu. And finally, that's a criticism you would hear from many American Jews as well. People who might even like AIPAC, maybe donated to AIPAC in the past, were involved, but think that over the last few years, the organization has become too affiliated with Netanyahu and his right-wing politics and his alliance with the Republican Party, and that hurts bipartisanship in support for Israel. So definitely that's interesting. But I would also just want to read the memoir for broader themes that are included, you know, his take on working with Republicans in the Senate. That's an issue that, again, could be relevant for Biden, and we could see the differences between them. And anything he would write about the 2016 election and the rise of Trump would be very interesting. I've been thinking about this for years. You know, does Obama regret any of his decisions in 2016, including at the time his advice to his friend and Vice President Joe Biden not to run in the 2016 election? Mm. We look at the results of 2016 versus 2020, and we have to wonder, what if?
What if? The biggest question of all time. What if? Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much. Amos Harel.
Thank you.
Emil Thibon.
Thank you.
And producer Aaron Ehrlich. Join us again next time on Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.